and welcome to David's Book Talk. And we have a special guest today. He has written a new book on Joe DiMaggio. It is the baseball season, after all. We're going to talk about it. It's called 56, Joe DiMaggio and the Last Magic Number in Sports. And his name is Kostya Kennedy, and he's here to join us. Am I saying that name right?
No, you've got it perfectly, yes.
Kostya. What kind of a name is Kostya, by the way?
Well, my given name is Konstantin, as was my grandfather, and Kostya is a derivative, Russian derivative, although I have no Russian blood. But my mother is a novelist, and she loved the Russian writers, of course. So Kostya, the figure in Anna Karenina and The Seagull and other works, and that's how I got my name.
So are you all Russian or part Russian? Or
I have no Russian blood whatsoever.
Oh, okay.
I have absolutely none. My father's British, and my mother is, her family was from Austria, and she grew up in the States.
Right, you have sort of there's some kind of accent there, and I'm just...
It probably comes from my dad, I guess, or I'm not sure, but I don't have Russian blood.
This book, you know, this, like I was telling you on the phone before we did the interview, it got me through when I was sick, when I had my bad cold, and it's just a fascinating look at Joe DiMaggio and this 56 hit streak that he had in, what year was it again?
1941,
yeah. That year sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Well, I think that was part of the whole interest, David. Of course, it's a baseball book, but for me to be interested in it as a writer, I didn't set out to write just a baseball book. And, of course, 1941 is probably the single most fateful year, or arguably the most fateful year of the 20th century. And the window that we're really looking at is a few months before Pearl Harbor comes. And already the year is sort of pregnant with portent. You know, people, we know that things are going to change because the war is going on in Europe. And although America's not yet involved, men are being drafted, and there's Roosevelt's going on the radio all the time and warning about the state of things, and it was partly that environment, I think, in that fragile time when we're out of the Depression, but we barely know it yet. I mean, it still hurts for so many families. That fragile time, I think, contributed to why this streak became so popular, and people began to follow it with such care, really, and seemed to have so much invested in whether this man got a base hit or not, which, of course, it didn't matter to any of their lives, but it seemed to, partly because of the time we were in.
Well, I wonder, not being around in 1941, but I wonder the interest in baseball in 1941 as opposed to what it is today. I mean, it's huge today. By the attendance, you do go through the attendance on a lot of these games, which is fascinating because you get to see, you know, attendance really wasn't as big as it is today. I mean, today it's like we have rabid fans today.
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, first of all, there were far fewer teams. Remember, there's no television even, David, so people haven't really... This boom of attendance is really relatively modern in baseball, so it doesn't attract that kind of numbers. But as a sport, baseball has an incredible hold on this country in 1941. I mean, big prize fights would gain a lot of attention, and some horse racing was really big. But there was no football wasn't really a big sport then. Neither was basketball or ice hockey. I mean, the sports all existed, of course, but they weren't part of the pulse of America the way baseball was. And it was definitely a sport that had a lot of interest. And, you know, minor league teams and the Pacific Coast Leagues out in California, where there were no major league teams, they drew pretty well themselves. So you didn't have sort of the critical mass the way you do today, have people at Fenway Park or Yankee Stadium, you know, 40,000 people a night going out to games. Although in today's economy that's come down a little bit, but the general spirit of that just wasn't the case then for the most part. Although in this hitting streak there were quite a number of sellouts, and there's no question that DiMaggio had a huge impact on the turnstile.
Right, and not to mention what ticket prices were then as to what they are now. I mean, you can easily spend $100 going to a game now.
Oh yeah. Easily, absolutely, David. I mean, it's one of the good seats, forget it.
And I love baseball. It certainly is, and things have changed so much in so many different ways. But this 56-game hitting streak Nobody's even come close. Well, we had somebody get 44. That was Pete Rose, right?
Yeah, and I guess in some ways that seems close because it's within 12, but on a percentage basis, that's really not very close at all. That's not even 80%. So that's one guy who got over 40. In the 70 years since DiMaggio did it, only one person has even gotten to 40. So.
Now, you and I disagree on Pete Rose. I mean, I'm angry at Pete Rose for what he did, but I respect that he was a great player. There's no doubt in my mind. And, you know, he always seemed afterwards so arrogant about it. I don't know. It just, you know, that's just what I remember in my mind. Now, I know I'm probably not looking at the whole picture, and yet, does he deserve to be in the Hall? Probably, definitely. But, I mean, in my mind, I think he probably should be in there. But, you know, it's such a subject that, you know, you could argue about forever. But it seems like...
There's no easy answer to that question whatsoever. And so, you know, and I respect every opinion on any side is worthy in the case of Pete Rose.
And I think it's interesting you included it. The reason I mentioned Pete Rose, you included a chapter telling all about what he's doing today. And you know, and it's interesting to read that to see what... And I didn't even know it was coming in the book, although I should have known because he was so close to the 56 that you might include something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I felt that it was one of the things I wanted to do in the book was also show that it is a record that's 70 years old, and much of the book does take place as we've been talking about it in 41, and that's when the narrative is. But it's definitely something that still has some resonance today. And most of the work on Rose is focused on his hitting streak in 78, and also a little bit of his relationship with DiMaggio. So it was a particular look at Rose and.
He had more than a couple connections with DiMaggio.
Yeah, well, he idolized him in many ways because one thing about DiMaggio is that he played very hard, and he always, you know, the famous quote about DiMaggio that, you know, he was hustling, running out of a little ground ball in this game that's 10-0 Yankees are winning or losing, and towards the end of his career when Joe had a lot of foot injuries and stuff, and people saying, well, why are you running so hard? It doesn't really matter. And he said, well, maybe there's somebody in the crowd that never saw me play.
That's an amazing comment. I read that, and I read that, and it just sticks with me, I think. Wow, that's really dedication.
It stuck with Pete Rose. I mean, I think that he felt the connection. He always felt an obligation to do that because of DiMaggio. And then when he, later in his life, when he had a chance to go to Vietnam in the late 60s with DiMaggio, then the relationship, you know, he spent some close time with him in a difficult environment, and so that connection was definitely there without question between those two.
Now, when did you decide to write this book, and how long did it take you to write it? It seems like you did a ton of research. I mean, there's just stuff in here, you know, things about the way he was feeling, and that it's almost like, I mean, it feels like you followed him around. Obviously, you didn't, because Joe DiMaggio has been dead for a number of years now. But tell me the genesis of this and how long it took.
Well, the genesis, I think, was initially, probably start to finish, took about 2.5 years. And I think the genesis was initially sort of the small end of the wedge. I was just thinking about all these records that have fallen in baseball, Babe Ruth's record and Hank Aaron and Roger Maris, and fell through the steroid era of baseball and kind of in an unhappy way. And the one record that was still there and that still had meaning in baseball circles and even outside the game was this 56. And so I wanted to sort of, that's what attracted me initially, just sort of there's a certain purity to the record. It had not been affected by the change of time. It had not been affected by the steroid era or anything else. So that was the initial thing that what attracted to me. And then the other thing that was appealing as I was going along, I mean, that little bit isn't enough for a book, of course, was the environment, as we spoke about, and the time that it was in America, and being able to sort of be transported back to that time and have people take me to life in 1941 and playing stickball on the streets of Queens, or being in New Jersey around a dinner table, and having people take me back to that time was something I really cherished and was very happy to have given to me by people. And the other element was, of course, the transformation in DiMaggio, because this is the event. DiMaggio now, everybody, whether you're a baseball fan or not, you know Joe DiMaggio and you have some thought about him, whether it's that he was married to Marilyn Monroe, or seeing him as this sort of silver-haired pitch man for Mr. Coffee or whatever it is.
But, you know, it's so interesting that we remember so much about that. I can see those commercials in my head. It was so indelible when he did it. It was like, wow, here's Joe DiMaggio, you know, a hero, a national hero doing a commercial.
Exactly. And he did those things. He was very, very selective. One of the reasons we remember that, too, is that he did very few commercials, which these days I think people are more likely to do more. But this was the event then, David, where he was transformed from being a baseball star, which he certainly was in 1940 and the start of 41, into being an American icon and being somebody that, you know, now your grandma is saying to you, hey, did Joe DiMaggio get a hit today? And there comes a song about, not just about Joe, but about the streak on the jukeboxes and on the radio. And that Joe DiMaggio song, and a good song by Les Brown, not some gimmick song by the, you know, just thought up by the team or anything like that, a real big band doing it. And that transformation was fascinating for me to see, this kid who's 26 years old undergoing this, and it was amazing to see the impact on him, because it was pretty acute. I mean, in the preceding winter of 40-41, and I think it was January, he went to Minnesota to visit his wife's family with his wife. He was married to an actress at the time. And he went into town and got some roses for the family. And that's it. He just kind of went into town and got roses. And nobody bothered him or anything. And he walked around the town, did a couple of other things, and came back with them. And you know, later on, there was a little local article in the paper, oh, Joe DiMaggio was in town and he did this. But that would have not been thinkable. He could have never done that once the streak had taken hold and people were now aware of it and sending him boatloads of fan mail and all that. So there was that transformation, and it affected him greatly, I think, that he was sort of an uneducated, an extravagantly uneducated man who'd never, not even didn't finish high school, but never went to high school, and whose parents, who were Italian immigrants, were illiterate in both Italian and English. And to have him now be in the spotlight in New York, he was very concerned and uncomfortable with how he would seem there and how he would, whether he would be overmatched or that whole element of not wanting to seem rubbish or anything. And that you can see that aloofness in him and that privacy. So all of those things, that the sort of three-armed, the baseball stuff, the time in the country, and just sort of being able to travel with a man as he, the stress of it every single day, of needing a hit, having people waiting on him to get it, having it be front page news in papers, New York, San Francisco, Montana, wherever you were, and seeing what that did was such a special and intriguing thing for me.
Now, how many years did he play?
He played 13 seasons.
13.
He missed three full seasons for World War II, and he was cut short kind of pretty young when he got short, but because of injuries. He had quite a number of, primarily towards the end, foot and heel injuries. But he battled injuries quite throughout his career.
That to me indicates he was you know, doing what he did so perfectly in his mind, running everything out, making sure he did everything. He played as hard as he possibly could, and I guess that took a toll on his legs.
Yeah, I don't know for sure whether that, you know, he may have just been prone to that.
Right.
But it's certainly, both of those things are true, that he did play extraordinarily hard, even by the measure of the day, and that he did suffer quite a number of injuries.
Well, what's interesting about the whole 56-game hitting streak is he never seems to get real excited about it. I mean, he seems like he went out every day and played his best and didn't, of course it had to be in the back of his head, but did he get overly excited about it at all?
Well, DiMaggio was very careful of his image and really didn't show things. So
he didn't want to be in the spotlight, obviously, because you have sections where you talk about how he's trying to get away from the press, and I mean how hard that.
He had room service pretty much every night as the streak started going. He would stay in his room with Lefty Gomez. He didn't want to be around the press. At the same time, he was very happy to have people put him on a pedestal, and he liked being the great DiMaggio,
right,
very much, and he liked what that meant and how it made him feel, but he did not like, people being all around him and everything. There's one point in the book where I talk about that he sort of has two fears when he's out in public, and one is that everybody's going to come and pay attention to him, and the other one is that nobody will. And that kind of gets to a little bit of his, he was a complicated person, and he had thought about things in different ways, and I think that that's pretty much his relationship with fame, that sort of...
It's interesting how fame is like a drug to some people, and I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing, but, you know, some people thrive on being famous.
Absolutely. And it was important for him, he was also aware, you know, he's somebody, he had his limitations intellectually and everything as I've alluded to, but he was really almost a genius in a way about his own image and about what he needed to make Joe DiMaggio be Joe DiMaggio. And fame was very important to him, not just for any his personal feelings of enjoying fame, but it was also very important to the Joe DiMaggio brand, if you will. I mean, they weren't thinking in those terms then, but to be Joe DiMaggio meant being somebody who was famous and somebody who stopped a room and all of that. And so that's, there were reasons why it was important to Joe were also practical. It meant probably making more money and all of that.
Now, of course, Dom, his brother, who was famous, but not as famous as, seems like Joe had the most notoriety in the whole family. And there was Mike. Did Mike play baseball, too?
Not professionally, no. Vince was in another.
And Vince,
there were two other ball players. The two other brothers were Mike and Tom. Tom was... The boys would always say he was the best of the players before he hurt his shoulder, although he didn't play professionally. Vince DiMaggio also played in the league. He was, of the three brothers, he had the least successful career. He's a very good outfielder, as they all were, but he struck out quite a bit and never, he just didn't have a great career. Vince hit some home runs, but not a great career. Dominic DiMaggio was a perfectly good ball player, not quite a Hall of Famer, but a borderline guy. There were some people who thought he would have a chance to get
it. Do you think he played as hard as his brother?
I think he did. Maybe not with that intensity, but he did play with... He knew who he was being compared to. You know, every time he's out there, there's no getting around it. He was Joe DiMaggio's little brother everywhere he went. Don was a different character in many ways. He was nicknamed with the Little Professor, and he wore these spectacles, and he was a very bright guy, and he did finish high school, and he went on to be quite successful after his career. And he was a good ball player. I mean, he hit over 300 in 1941. He and Joe played in the All-Star game together. There's a chapter about that All-Star game, and they had a very complicated relationship. There was a lot of jealousy both ways in that relationship. But he played with a certain dedication to the game, but I think that what Joe had was above and beyond. It was a pretty special commitment.
I don't think you realize, you know, and I watch baseball all the time, but you never really realize how much they put into these games and how much these ball players are dedicated to what they do. I mean, it is a grueling schedule. I mean, there are some weeks you work 6 days a week, and
yes,
there are some weeks you work five, and I mean, it's all different. And yeah, you get the time off between whatever it is, November all the way up to, I guess, February. It really isn't that much time when you think about it. But when they play hard. They're traveling all the time. How do you keep a relationship? How do you keep a wife? How do you keep kids? You know, how in the world does the relationship survive through all that?
Well, many don't, of course. And it is, and it probably was, although the travel wasn't across the coast as much in those days, then they were taking trains. They didn't have the sort of charter airplane waiting for them to go. They took trains everywhere, and it wasn't you know, you expected to play every day, and there wasn't a lot of resting unless, of course, you were injured. You know, let's still say they're still playing baseball. I don't think it was there are plenty of people who do real hard work, are building our roads and doing things like that, who work just as hard, or much harder, I should say, much harder. But the one element I think you touched on, the travel is difficult and does make it difficult for relationships, there's no question, and very hard on families. Of course, there's the whole, these guys are, you know, they're famous and rich, and they go out at night, and maybe they meet somebody and all that. But even just, and that's a big factor, but even just being away is a big factor. And I think that, you know, I was able to get into Joe's relationship with his first wife, Dorothy Arnold, a little bit. And I don't know for sure how much his travel schedule and all of that ended up being a part of their ultimately not succeeding in the marriage, because they during the hitting streak, Dorothy is pregnant with Joe's son, but they would end up being divorced in the early 40s.
And how many years were they married?
They were married about 4 years. They were married in 39. They began their separation in 42, but they weren't officially divorced until 44. So it's a little, it's not a totally clean answer, but 3 or 4 years or so. Basically.
You wonder how the wives do it. I mean, to be, their husbands are away that much. I mean, they don't see them all that much.
And uh-huh.
I mean, I guess they go home at night during the home games and stuff, but, you know, it's still not, and by the time they get home, they must be exhausted. I mean, when you think about keeping a relationship together, I mean, how difficult it must be. And the thing with Dorothy, I wanted to bring this up, the one thing that strikes me as very incredibly wonderful is that the fact that she was sitting with him that one night and talked about that he was doing something wrong. She noticed he was doing something different. The way he was swinging,
right?
And
yeah, he was he had been in a bad slump. It was actually the year before 1941, and he just had been slumping, and he couldn't seem to get out of it. And one night at dinner, Dorothy, sort of timidly, because she was a little hesitant about saying these kind of things to Joe, as anybody might, but you know, Joe could be difficult to get close to, even if you were his wife. And she said, you know, I think I noticed something that you're about the way you are at bat that might help you. And he sort of shrugged it off, but then he let her say something to him, and she said, you know, you're number five. She always sat in the same spot, I should say. Always sat in the same spot behind home plate, a little bit toward the third base side. And she said, your number five isn't in the same spot when you finish your swing that it usually is. And when she said that, something clicked for Joe, and he realized that she was right, and she... and he had been overstriding just a little bit.
I think the lesson is don't discount people just because you don't think they know what they're talking about.
Exactly.
I mean, there are people who can say things that will help you that you wouldn't even expect.
Of course, you're exactly right. And I think that was and he was, although he was totally happy to repeat that story. He was proud that it had happened. You know, he thought it was funny, and he was not embarrassed by any way that had happened, and it really truly did help him. I mean, he took that information the next step and applied it to his stride, and then went and worked on some things, but he credited it with getting himself out of a slump.
Now, what I really love about this book, 56, and that what really drives the book to me, is the fact that you go through these games, you go through all the different games as it gets higher up, as it gets into the 30s and 40s and 50s, and each game is so fascinating to read about. I mean, the way you describe it, the way you talk about the weather, what it was like beforehand, what his mood was, what people were saying to him, is just utterly fascinating. And that's what makes this book so interesting. Because we think, you know, it could be just, you could just list what happened and that would be it. But the way you describe it in detail, it just elevates it to a whole new high and makes the book that much better.
Well, I'm so glad that you had that response. You know, I wanted to read as a narrative and read as a novel almost. And to do that, of course, you had to have, I needed a tremendous amount of information. So I totally over-reported everything. I mean, in those days, there were, you know, 9, 10, 11 newspapers covering every game. And then at certain times during the streak, there were many more than that. So it was a lot of plumbing back to that, as well as a lot of interviews with people, including, and I should have said this earlier, that Dominic DiMaggio gave me some very valuable time and to talk with him about many things. And he's since passed away, and I'll always be grateful to him because it was a time in his life when he could have easily said, you know what, I just don't have time to do this now, given what was going on in his life, but he did. He made the time, and I'm grateful for that.
Now, did you talk to other people that knew him?
Oh, yeah, a lot of people. I mean, I was interested in people who knew him, of course, and also interested in people who knew him at that time. So there were other ball players that I spoke to, like Bob Feller and Herman.
He's still alive.
He's not
alive. Okay.
Yeah, he recently passed away.
I'm just be thinking of something.
But, and there were other people. The guy I found who got to know Joe much, really, really well, much later. He'd been a Yankee bat boy in '43, and he was close to Joe around that time, just after the hitting streak. When I say close, I mean physically close. He was around him, and then later, as their lives took different turns, he ended up being quite a good friend of DiMaggio's. And there are a number of people. He still had some old friends who were still alive in San Francisco, and I spoke to them. I mean, I did the whole, you spoke to anybody who I could who would shed some light on it.
Right. I mean, that just makes it more fascinating when you talk to somebody who actually knew him and could tell you his... But it's interesting you talk about his moves and you talk about the different games and who was pitching and what he was up against and whether certain ones that were hit really should have been called hits. Were there some in your mind that shouldn't have been called hits that were? Would have ended the streak?
There was one that I was really interested in looking at. I thought it might have been the case. It was about game 30. And there was a ball that took a bad hop and nearly sort of glanced off the shoulder of Luke Appling, who was the shortstop for the Chicago White Sox. And many years later, some people, it's the kind of thing, you know, people get a little fidgety because here's this great record and who can explain it and all that. And they started looking into it and some people said, well, you know, that really should have been an error, that play. And maybe the scorer was generous. And I was interested in that, and maybe that could have been the case. So I went back and really looked into this, looked at all the separate accounts of that play, and got as much information as I could. Of course, there's no videotape of it.
I was just going to ask you if there any video. There wasn't.
Yeah, no, there's no... There's occasional clips of him from that summer from that would appear on the newsreels before you went to the movie, but there's no game tape of any kind for the regular season games. So, but every account described it as a bad hop. Nobody questioned whether it was a hit or an error at all. He certainly got lucky in that instance, and you don't have a long streak. You don't even have a 35-game streak without a lot of luck, as my research showed. I mean, you need luck to have a long hitting streak. So he did get lucky in that game and maybe one or two others, but there was no place that looking into it where it ever seemed that a ball that should have been called an error was called a hit. In fact, there were times when it would go the other way around. There was in the late 30s, he hit a ball that looked like it was a borderline hit or error, and the official scorer was weighing it for a minute, and the other Yankee players actually came out to the top step of the dugout and turned around and looked at the scorer, who was Dan Daniel, to try to sort of influence him. Joe Gordon, who was a prominent Yankee at that time, did that, as well as some other players. And Daniel still called it an error anyway. So it does, there did not seem to be any time when he got a hit that he should not have been awarded at all.
Which makes it even cleaner, the whole thing even more remarkable and more even cleaner than... I mean, to think that you have a record, and I don't know how he felt when he died, whether he felt that it would stay this long. I mean, I don't know if he'd be amazed that it has stayed this long. Maybe he would be. It is a pretty incredible record. I mean,
it is. I mean, it's amazing, particularly because it seems like, well, you'd have to go 1-for-4. It's not really that hard, but it's really, really, really very hard.
Especially with the way pitchers are today. I mean, there's so many different pitchers now.
And people would think that might have an impact. I don't think it really has any impact on the likelihood or not likelihood of getting a hitting streak. But even at the time, there were people, Joe himself didn't say it right at that time, but other people around him were saying, oh, this is a record that'll never be broken, even right as he was doing it. And when Rose was on his streak, as we alluded to earlier, that in 1978, DiMaggio was asked, Joe was probably at about 40, and DiMaggio was asked, would he like to see Rose break his streak, meaning break his 56, and DiMaggio said, no, definitely not. He was very happy to have that streak. He knew what it meant to him. He knew what it meant to his legacy. He would have been a great ball player without the streak. If he'd had a 35-game hitting streak that year and that was it, he would have gone down as a great ball player, won a few MVPs, won 9 World Series, played in 10, Hall of Famer, so on and so on. But this really elevated him to being, as he was known, the greatest living ball player for the last 30 years of his life. Joe DiMaggio was de facto the greatest living ball player. He was very happy to wear that crown, and he would not have been, he was actually voted that at a Major League Baseball dinner in 1969. And as people who were there that night talked to me about it, and as was known, there's just no chance he would have gotten it without that streak. You know, at the time when Mays had done most of his work, Sam Musial, a lot of people thought he should get it, Ted Williams, of course, Mantle, I mean, there were plenty of people who had, who could have laid claim to that, And DiMaggio got it in no small part because of this summer and this achievement.
And nobody has batted 400 since Ted Williams, have they?
No, they haven't.
This season, and that's another record that, you know, they'll come close to, but who knows if they'll ever break that. That's a pretty impressive record. I mean, there's so many, even though there's tons of hitters today, and there's just not the electricity sometimes that there was with Ted Williams. I mean, he had something special. I think it'll ever be broken? It might, but it's going to take a lot to do it.
Well, he's not it's not actually a record. He's just the last guy to do it. And so whether or not somebody will even hit 400, that's the big question. I don't think that somebody's going to hit 400 either. But I think that I would, if the question was, are we going to see somebody hit 400 or somebody hit have a 56-game hitting streak, I'd definitely wager that we're going to see somebody hit 400 before 56.
Now, how long have you been with Sports Illustrated?
I've been there since the mid-90s.
Almost 21 years?
No.
Mid-90s, that would be 16,
well,
17
years. Like 15 years.
About 15 years.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
It is. It's a great place. I've been privileged and happy to do a lot of really good work, both writing and editing. I've been, done a lot of different things at the magazine. It's been a great place and still is a great place.
Now, is the plan to write books about other players, or is this a one-time thing with writing about players?
No, I've got a couple of other ideas. I'm not quite ready to say what they are, Dave, because I'm still kind of working on it, but I think I would like to do, I may do one more baseball book and then do something else after that.
How much of your life is baseball? I mean, is it a big part of your life?
Yes. I mean, it's a big... Professionally, yeah, I've covered baseball. I also spent a lot of time covering hockey. And it hasn't not always been... It's been a sport that I have not wanted to cover day-to-day for many reasons, because I almost didn't want to spoil it. You know, you can see what goes on in the inner workings of a game, and I have covered quite a bit of baseball and written a lot of features and columns on baseball. But I didn't want to sort of be there every day and day in, day out, and make it a grind. I wanted to preserve some passion for it, and I've been able to do that. So I think that it's the sport that I love the most, and it will, you know, I find the most interesting and the most layered and the most, in some ways, complex. So as a writer, it's definitely the most interesting sport for me.
I mean, of course, with the Manny Ramirez thing, after 19 years, he just suddenly ups and gives up.
Manny's done it any other way in some ways, you know?
I mean, in some ways, it's typical of him, yes. But
right.
In other ways, you know, somebody who is so into the sport that he has been, I mean, and is such a major character in the sport.
Right.
Now, I'm not condoning him cheating. I mean, that, to me, that's
right,
whatever he did. I think it's pretty well known that he has admitted to some things. What exactly, I don't know. But he is one of those people in baseball you can't wait to hear something else about, because he's so interesting to begin with. You never know what he's going to say.
Right. I mean, and he was at times infuriating, because he was, you know, he wasn't hustling when he had like a pretend ankle injury or things like that. He really rubbed some Red Sox fan the wrong way. And other times, you know, you're wondering, he has to make sure he has enough bars on his cell phone because he's going to make a phone call while he's in left field. And then there's great moments of him sort of running back to get a ball off the wall and taking a step, climbing up the wall, high-fiving a fan, and then throwing the ball back into the infield. Stuff like that is incredibly endearing in some ways. You know, he played loose and happily and was a lot of fun to watch. And, of course, he was a great hitter. I mean, during his heyday, he was an absolute great hitter. Now, the whole performance-enhancing drug thing really changes everything in an evaluation of him.
It really does. It's such a shame.
It absolutely does. So
you just figure, the first thing you think of is, why the heck would anybody do that and ruin what is a spectacular, I mean, he's going so spectacularly well, and why would somebody do that? And I mean, is it all about making the most money you can possibly make? And why is that so important?
I think that it
I mean, it was important for Joe DiMaggio, but he was making what? At the height, at one point, he was making $25,000 a year. Did he make more than that at some point?
I'm sorry. Did he make more than what?
Yeah, I think you point out in the book he was making $25,000 a year.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. He signed the first $100,000 contract.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, not within, don't hold me to it, David, but I think it was 1950, 49, 50, or 51, right around there.
And that was a lot of money back then. But
oh, yeah, it was a lot of money. I mean,
but today it's nothing for ball players to make, I mean.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think that gives us a window into, you say, why would people do it? There's no excuse whatsoever. I'm not making any excuse for anybody. But I will just say that if you have that kind of money available and you think that you're going to do something that's going to keep your career going and other people are doing it and so on, well, you know, one thing leads to another and all of a sudden you have these people doing this. Again, I'm not making any excuse. I'm just saying one can sort of envision.
No, that's your opinion, and I agree with it. But that doesn't make us all right. But, you know, we all have our different opinions. And, you know, I never was a big Manny Ramirez fan because he's not only the teams that I've liked. So, and he's always seemed like a perfect batter. I mean, especially earlier in his career, he just couldn't do anything but hit. I mean, my mom was a big Red Sox fan, but she'd be horrified to hear everything that's going on with him now because it sullies the game to me, and it would sully the game to her, too.
Right.
It's like suddenly a team deciding they get four outs an inning, you know.
Absolutely, I totally agree. I mean, I think it's completely wrong, and it's wrong to the fans. That's the biggest thing, and it's for everybody who's been implicated in this. It's baseball is in some ways it's silly to say, but in some ways it is kind of a national trust. I mean, people love this game and they're invested in it. And just in our conversation now, you know, you have your feelings about it, and I have my feelings about it, and we think about it rationally, and we think about it emotionally, and we, all of that, and it really is a betrayal to fans, I think.
I wonder what Joe DiMaggio would have thought.
I don't know, you know, it's a good question. You know, I think he would have been very loath to put a needle into his body, for one thing, I would say. And I don't think that he would have, you know, I think I don't think this is the route that he would have gone.
Was there a chapter in this book that was harder to write than any others, or was it all pretty, I mean, you being loving sports as much as you do, did it make this book easier to write?
I don't know how to say it. I mean, there were some times that it, you know, came better than others, and there were some days that were where the writing was just came more easily and all that. But I don't think there was a particular subject matter that was more or less difficult to tackle. I felt that, you know, once I kind of found a voice and knew where I was going, then I just kind of went there. I let the book lead me as much as I let it.
Now, the cover has when he hit in the 42nd game on June 29th, 1941. I'm just reading this because I didn't realize that was from that date.
Right.
But, and you look at Joe, he just looks so driven in that picture.
Yeah, he was the young man, as I said, he's 26, and he was driven. He was absolutely focused and dedicated, and that's one reason why he could be cold and standoffish, even to his teammates, and nobody wanted to get on Joe's bad side, because he could be a tough one. There was no question about it.
Was he superstitious?
He was not. He was not superstitious. But what I was just leading to then is I think that commitment to the game, even for the players that had some difficulty with him or just had difficulty getting close to him, everybody just really respected him and respected the way he played, because he was a player of great highlights and everything, of course, and prodigious skills as a fielder and a hitter and a runner. But he was also just simply a grinder. I mean, he played the game tough in and out every day, and that won the respect of people who played with him, you know, above all else. That's the most valuable thing you can be if you're a teammate, and that's a big thing that people respected him.
Are there any audio interviews of him? Did anybody ever do an interview with him?
Oh, sure. There's plenty of those, and they, particularly later in his career and later in his life. And there is some video. There's plenty of video. There just isn't really sort of game stuff, and there isn't this from 41. There isn't, because games weren't on TV. TV had been invented and was around, but it wasn't in anybody's home at that point. So you know, there's plenty of. There's not plenty. I mean, compared to a lot of other players, there's a dearth of material, but there certainly are existing interviews. And video and audio. One thing that I was able to find from 41, Lou Gehrig dies that year.
Right.
And this was a major event, and people from all over baseball were asked to go on the radio and talk about it, including DiMaggio, and on a radio station that was broadcast nationally. And I was able to get that that audio tape and hear what he was saying at that time then. And there are a few other things out there, but it's pretty slim.
Now, this book, and I didn't mention this before, but it's from Sports Illustrated. Do they actually have their own publishing at the end of it, end of things, for books?
Yeah. It's through Time, Inc., and it's a publishing house that's independent of the magazine. I mean, obviously, it's all a big umbrella, but they publish books independently of what's happening in the weekly magazine.
Now, I have to ask you, how many games do you get to, let's say, the 2011 season, how many games will you get to?
It really just depends. I mean, I'll say 20, 25. But I don't know exactly what it'll be. You know, if I do get on doing a story or I have something going on, maybe I'll get to a lot more than that. But then I'll go to a few just and sit in the stands, and I'll go to, you know, I say 25 is probably a good guess of about how many.
Now, you also mentioned Yogi Berra in this book, I think, at one point. Now, Yogi Berra, is he still alive?
Yogi's still alive, yep. He was not with the Yankees then in 41. He came just after that. He was in St. Louis that year. And I don't... he is mentioned in there, but he's not... He wasn't... And I did get some comments from him about DiMaggio, but he was not... He's not a central figure in the book at all. I mean, he just mentioned in passing. Phil Rizzuto was an important figure that year, and he was just a rookie.
Amazing. I mean, and yeah. I still can hear him on the Yankees telecast all these years now, and
terrific.
Just the way his voice would rise, and you know, sort of like Harry Callis, who to me is everything. But you know, just the way he'd get excited, and they call him Scooter, and you know, and he would always argue with the other announcer. I mean, it would just make it so much more interesting. I mean, so many. They have so many people announcing games who used to be players who may or may not be any good. I mean, you listen to them, sometimes they're good, sometimes they're not very interesting. Sometimes they're just talking, you know, and everybody's different. I'm very critical about who announces because I like what I like. I mean, I'm used to Joe Garagiola and Tony Kubek and those Saturday afternoon games that will always stick in my mind as having some of the best announcers ever.
Right.
Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are great announcers. I mean, my favorite announcer of all is Vin Scully.
Right.
And
he's still going strong. I don't know how old he is, but he's
still going great, and he's a wonderful, partly because he knows when not to say anything, which is a wonderful attribute, I think, in an announcer to just know when to let the story speak for itself. And then a television announcer, of course, can't do that so much on the radio. But no, I think that we all have our personal preferences, and sometimes it's who we were listening to growing up, and sometimes it's whatever it is. But again, it goes back to we're talking about the way baseball appeals to people on different levels, emotionally, and all that. And I think that the person who's the medium for you has a big part of how we interpret it.
Now, was there anything you didn't put in the book that you wanted to, or change your mind, or thought people wouldn't enjoy, or was there anything at all?
Not really. I mean, there are, of course, you know, as I said, I over-reported, so there's many things that aren't in there that I might have included, but I didn't feel there was any, there wasn't any sort of, you know, huge strand of the plot or anything like that I left out, or anything that, at this point, you know, maybe when there's a little more distance from it and I read the book in a couple of years, I'll feel something, and maybe I could have included something, but at this point, David, I don't really feel that I've left something out that I wanted to.
As you're reading the book, it's getting higher and higher in the streak. You want it to stay there. Of course, there's the Pete Rose chapter, which is inserted right in the middle of it, which is cool. But you find yourself saying, "Oh, I can't wait to get back to the streak to see what he's doing." I mean, you're so anxious to get. But it's good that you included those chapters. I really think it adds something to the book.
Well, I'm glad you like that. I mean, that is the modern perspective, as I said. And I kind of set them apart. You know, we call them The View from Here. And they are written in kind of a different voice. And it is supposed to be a more modern time. And they're set aside. If somebody wanted to skip a chapter and come back to it or something like that, they could certainly do that. They are placed in the book at strategic points, so that there's a chapter on the psychology of a hitting streak and how one gets self-conscious about it, and that appears sort of right after the moment when we know that DiMaggio himself was first aware of it. So they're in there with, and I hope after the whole thing, one of the chapters is the probability aspect of it, and that was an interesting chapter to get in. I guess I would say that was a difficult chapter just because I had to learn a lot of just basic probability theory, which isn't, I don't have a math background. I couldn't be writing equations at all. When you're with people who really know what they're talking about, you can't do it. But you can get to a point where you sort of understand it and see how probability theory works, at least in this instance, and so on. And that chapter, I felt I needed to pay attention to this because there's been a lot written on it by people like Stephen Jay Gould and other very well-known non-sports guys, but probability theorists who wanted to see the chances of there being such a hitting streak because it's something they can measure easily and all of that. And I put that chapter at the end, after the epilogue, and it's there, and one can read it, or you can save it to the end. I didn't want it to get in the way of the main narrative, but I wanted to include it. So there were certain sort of decisions made about how and when to include different aspects.
Now, I didn't ask you, but is this your first book?
It is, yes.
I almost said novel. I have no idea why I said novel. Obviously, it's all nonfiction, but this is your first book.
It is, yeah.
You could have a really long career in publishing. You realize that?
Well, from your mouth to God's ear, thank you. I do plan to continue it.
Do you think we'll have to wait another 2.5 years for the next one?
I think it'll take some time. I mean, I have a job and a family, and those are wonderful things in my life that take a lot of time. And I'm going to be hard at work on another book soon, but it's going to take a little time, and then take time to publish and all that. So
now, have you reached the New York Times bestseller yet?
We're on the list. We've been on the list for a few weeks now, for about 4 weeks. So.
Oh, congratulations! That's wonderful.
Yeah.
For a first-time author, that's amazing.
Very nice.
Of course, yeah, and of course, this book gets a lot of attention because it's Joe DiMaggio, and there's a lot of people out there who still love him, and you've done a great job with the whole thing, and it really has, it's been fun to read this book, and it's been even more fun to talk to you about it.
Well, it's been my pleasure, David. I've really enjoyed it, and it's great to talk with somebody who understands it so well, and it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, and the book again is called 56, Joe DiMaggio and the last magic number in sports. It's published by Sports Illustrated. It's in all your bookstores. We've been talking to the author, Kostya Kennedy, and we will talk to you next time.